Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Not with me today is Nadia Oxford. She is busy doing Black Friday stuff, and I am recording a little earlier than I normally would because Thanksgiving starts tomorrow. It's going to be a slightly shorter episode, maybe just slightly, and I'm just taking a moment to introduce the show before we head into our discussion of the next top 25 RPG episode. As usual, busy week over on US Gamer. As of the recording of this episode, which would be several days ago by the time this episode goes up, we got a big report dropping on the site about Diablo 4, which was pretty interesting, especially the fact that apparently Diablo 4, Blizzard is working, was originally conceiving it as almost like Dark Souls, which I think would have been interesting from a Blizzard context, but man, can you imagine the uproar if that had actually happened? There's been a few false starts. You should go check out that article. I mean, as usual, Jason Schreier doing an excellent job of breaking all that down. Beyond that, we have a look back on Warframe and its journey from just another free-to-play shooter to one of the best games of the generation. Mike did an in-depth hands-on on Super Smash Bros. And talked to Nintendo about that. And I have a nice little article about my quest for the perfect heist in Red Dead Redemption 2 and what that taught me. And Nadia has a meaty Ocarina of Time retrospective. It was the 20th anniversary of The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time last week. As usual, The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time is not an RPG, but it's pretty dang close. It is a pretty excellent action-adventure game with puzzle elements and that kind of thing. So go check out her article there. As usual, you can find us on all of the social media channels. I'm at @_Kappa. Nadia's at Nadia Oxford. And follow us on USGamerNet and all of that. If you want to comment on this episode, drop me a line at kat.bailey@usgamer.net. Send me a message on Twitter or drop me an email. I got a couple of nice emails from readers just recently saying that they really enjoyed the show. Thank you so much. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a review over on iTunes. So, okay, we're going to continue on to talking about number 10 on our top 25 RPG list. Don't go away. Okay, it is time for the top 10 of the top 25 RPG countdown. We've been going at this for a while, and this is like kind of an exciting moment. We are going to begin to unveil like the big one, the part of the list that I feel like we really kind of have to get right. And I think that we are starting with an all-time classic. Number 10 on our list is Baldur's Gate 2, widely regarded as one of the best RPGs of all time, possibly one of the best D&D RPGs of all time. And here to talk about it with me is Troy Goodfellow, who, when I showed him the list, he said, Baldur's Gate 2, it has to be that one.
Well, as I recall, you gave me the choice between this and Planescape, and they were both, you know...
Spoiler alert, Planescape Torment's going to be on this list?
Imagine the odds.
What a shock.
Yeah. And there are two games that I know that both came along. I mean, I'm one of those people who believes that, you know, great games speak to you because they come to you at the right moment in your life. These types of games came along at the right moment in my life for me to really appreciate what they were doing. And Baldur's Gate 2, Shadows of Om, or Shadows of Omen, or Shadows of Omn, depending on what you do with your MN there at the end, it really... is a landmark, I think, both for BioWare and for RPGs in general.
What was that moment in your life? Take me back.
This was, God, this is late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, I've been getting back into gaming really, really heavily I had some time. I was just working my PhD, so I had lots of time, just going through grad school. And my then wife, my ex-wife now, but my then wife was a lapsed gamer, but she wanted to play too. So she started getting into PC role-playing games, starting going back to some of the classics, like Betrayal of Krondor. And then she found Baldur's Gate sitting for sale in her local store, and she picked it up. And at that time, she was going through carpal tunnel issues. So I would drive the characters, and she would give me instructions. So she would be barking the orders, I'd be filling them out for her. This whole BioWare thing, all of these games, Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2, and then the companion games from Black Isle, the Icewind Dale games, and then eventually Neverwinter Nights, they became sort of... They became really big parts of our household. We pick up sayings from the game, we pick up quotations, we would refer to the games over and over again. They were a thing that we shared. And I think it's you just have the beginnings of a communal internet where people are talking in these ways in like the late 90s. Forums are starting to pick up. Usenet is dying away and because things are more user-friendly. So it's easier to find people to talk to about these things, to find tips, to find advice. And I think the Baldur's Gate games and the BioWare engine games came along at the right time for this, for people to come together, play the games together, share the experience, and talk about the experience in a very important and active and engaged way. My ex eventually became a big-time Neverwinter Nights dungeon master. She designed her own dungeons and all of this stuff. And I think it really came through, that became a big part of her life and her pastimes and her relaxation because of what the Baldur's Gate games did, what they meant to her. In ways that, she loved KOTOR and she loved all the other BioWare stuff, but nothing really spoke to her, or I think even to me, as much as Baldur's Gate did.
Yeah, and this was a really special time for RPGs. I've talked about it before, but the late 90s was an amazing time, both on the PC and on console. On console, we had Final Fantasy VII and such revolutionizing how we saw JRPGs here in the West. And on PC, we had games like all-time classics like Fallout, Planescape Torment, Deus Ex, Baldur's Gate 2. It was an amazing run.
Yeah, it's there's a lot to be... BioWare had something special with these games. And I think because they were such faithful translations of a system a lot of old-time role players knew, there had been D&D games before. I'm old enough to remember the old gold box and silver box D&D games from the 1980s, the SSI games, the Dragonlance stuff, and the Silver Blades games. And they were all right. But the pseudo-real-time, the pausable real-time nature of the battles in the Baldur's Gate games and the Icewind Dale games made the D&D system come to life in a really interesting way. Baldur's Gate 2 took the... It came out, I think, right after a new version of D&D had come out, or right around the same time. Time's a little bit off here, because there's always a new version coming out. So it had all of these different, all the different classes and all the different rules, and there was a magic's arms race going on throughout the game. So it really did feel like you were engaged in high-level D&D combat. And if you were someone who grew up with D&D and was familiar with how that could feel in a tabletop setting, really nothing had come close in a very, very long time to matching that experience.
So did you play the original Baldur's Gate?
I did. Well, we did, yes.
So what was your impression of Baldur's Gate 2 when it came out? Like, I know for a lot, at the contemporary reviews are just like, wow, Baldur's Gate 2, man, it takes everything that Baldur's Gate 1 did and just does it so much better.
I think the first thing that hit me was just how staggeringly big it was. The game, I think we measured games in hours, probably still do, and it was, I think, easily twice as large as far as time and areas to explore as the first Baldur's Gate was. And it starts in a really interesting way. I mean, the first Baldur's Gate starts with, can't have spoilers for a 20-year-old game, but here we are. The first Baldur's Gate starts with, your adoptive father gets killed in a crossroads and you're an orphan, and then you've got to go and find your way out in the wild world, you know, a very traditional RPG setting. And you start low level and you kill your rats and then you become a god. But Baldur's Gate 2 starts with there's been an interlude. In between the two games, your character has been captured with your party, you're being tortured and experimented on, and it's this prison break thing. And you're still very powerful. You're not bumped down to level one, whatever level your character was imported into, or you can create a new character. And you start strong, and you're surrounded with some pretty good equipment that you can find. You can't always identify it, but you can tell it's magical and quite powerful. And your party members you can find are still quite powerful. So you're already, you know, taking down, you're taking down demons, you're taking down Atyas, you're taking down, you know, dark dwarves and stuff at the very first mission. So you can tell this is going to be a huge adventure just from the first crap they throw at you. These aren't, you know, kobolds and giant rats. And then you step out, you escape out of the prison, and one of your party members is whisked away, and you have to go on a GoFundMe spree trying to get enough gold raised so you can pay off one of the brigands competing for your loyalty, saying they can get your friend freed from the magical prison. And it just sucks you right in immediately into a high-stakes mystery where you don't quite know what's going on. It's not like the other RPGs, even the first Baldur's Gate, where you know there's a big bad who's dominating the area and you've got to take him down in the end. So you go down through all these mini-bosses all the way through. Baldur's Gate 2 is a lot more episodic all the way throughout the game. Many of the quests are just there for you to meet new people or to raise the gold to pay off whoever you need to pay off. The 20,000 gold to continue on to chapter... chapter 2 is just super long. You have to raise, because you're just raising all this gold to get through chapter 2. So the size of it, the different venues you travel to, and you can tell right from the very beginning with the stakes and you're presented with and all the wizards teleporting in, telling what you can and cannot do, that you are a somebody, that you are a powerful being expected to do powerful things. And that was really nice to see, and not something that was quite common in RPGs then. I'm not sure how common it is now.
I'm still just stuck on magical GoFundMe campaign. I do like that idea. Aren't all RPGs magical GoFundMe campaigns one way or another? Sometimes those contributions aren't exactly, I don't know, consensual, but what can I say? Baldur's Gate 2 launched in 2000. It was developed by BioWare, and it probably really helped that BioWare wasn't developing the Infinity Engine in conjunction with the development of the actual game, so they could focus on actual content. And God, did they really load content into this game. You mentioned that it felt gigantic. I mean, this game was like 300 hours long if you did all of the content. The main story itself was on the order of like 60 hours. It was not a short game. It launched in 2000. It subsequently got an expansion called Throne of Baal, which I don't think is especially well remembered.
I remember my ex-wife finishing it while I was out of town and being very annoyed.
Very annoyed. Why is that?
Well, because she finished it and I wasn't there to see it. She played through all.
You were very annoyed.
I was annoyed. She was fine because she got to play her game, but I didn't get to see how it ended. So I still haven't played Throne of Baal.
Oh wow. Okay. I mean, and even now, after all these years with the enhanced edition out and everything,
I don't have time for games. I barely have time for the games that we publish, let alone 20-year-old games.
That's okay. I don't have time for them either. And I write about them for a living. But the thing that's interesting about this, though, it is a Dungeons & Dragons game. It's set in the Forgotten Realms, which is one of the most popular settings in the Dungeons & Dragons world. It is based on the AD&D 2nd Edition rules. And those were the rules that institutionalized Thaco. I want to say popularized, but I don't know if Thaco was ever that popular. And that is to hit armor class 0. Basically, if your attack roll is higher or equal to your Thaco minus the enemy's armor class, you hit. Apparently, this was a house rule back in the days of like the original D&D and then AD&D, and it was eventually codified into for AD&D Second Edition. Troy, did you do a lot of Dungeons and Dragons playing?
I did a little bit in college, not a whole lot. It was very hard to find a group that wasn't full of awful people. The perennial problem. But it is, you know, something that I've always had friends who were into it, so I was always aware of what was going on. And even now, like, I have the documents, I have the manuals, but I don't play a lot. I do remember, reading a lot of stuff about D&D because I was into gaming, and it was there's always a discussion over, you know, God, Thaco, what a stupid way to calculate armor. But it's, you know, one of these legacy things. It just sticks around. And I'm sure there are still purists out there who think Thaco is the right way to roll for an armor hit or not. But I was too prepared for this. I thought I would roll a new character and try to refresh myself as to how these things go. And one of my friends says his favorite part of Icewind Dale was the character generator. And he would never actually play the game. He would just keep generating characters over and over again. And it's kind of the same thing you could get into with Baldur's Gate 2. And we see this in the new Pathfinder game as well, where a really good character generator just offers all of these new amazing options, the things you can do. It doesn't look really all that outstanding in today's RPG character creators. Baldur's Gate 2 was so faithful to the second edition stuff. I mean, I was wrong about a paladin because I'm a classic white knight. And what kind of paladin do you want to be? There are like five or six different paladins. I forgot. Oh, cavalier. I forgot all about cavaliers and all of these different types of paladins. Like, and you cannot just be, you know, your super squeaky clean knight. You can be a paladin of evil and all of these other options. And you could all of the way through, you know, the illusionist options.
So are you good or evil?
Oh, I'm always good. I'm always a good character. I have a very hard time playing evil.
Yeah, me too. I don't know if you've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2, but it required a real shift in my mindset to be intentionally evil, because I don't know, when I'm playing an RPG, I just never go evil.
I'm not playing RDR, I don't have a PS4, RPGs, I'm always choosing the good option. I'm always, you know, getting the kitten down from the tree, and that's just the kind of person that I am. That's the kind of person I would like to be. And I try to reflect that in my RPG playing. And, you know, Baldur's Gate gives you lots of options to be, you know, the hero, you know, saving Eri from a circus. Or each of the classes has their own special set of subquests. Some of the fighters and paladins, they can have a fortress to protect. And if you clear out the fortress of baddies, then you get the fortress. Then you rule as a just king or just lord over your manor. Now all these little quests coming in for that in the Everlords chapter 2. And I was always taking, you know, the very best, most positive, just options.
Yeah, Baldur's Gate 2 is interesting. I don't know how many RPGs do this, but it picks up from the original Baldur's Gate in more ways than one. Not only can you import a character, it basically starts with the characters already being fairly powerful. There's not really the kind of reset that you see in a lot of these types of games. Often you'll be playing a sequel and for no particular reason, all of a sudden they're very weak again, even though, you know, you got the ultimate infinity armor and the best sword plus one in the previous game. Well, the weapons in Baldur's Gate 2 are often, even at the beginning, are often stronger than the original Baldur's Gate. And I found that to be a pretty bold design choice in an RPG of this scope.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, in many ways, the start is kind of a classic RPG trope. The party is captured and thrown into prison without all of their weapons and armor. That happens in so many RPGs. And in this case, yeah, you don't have your stuff, but it's a wizard's lair. So you can go around, you can root through his stuff, you can root through his chests and cabinets, and you will find, you know, good magic swords. You know, plus one, plus two stuff. The armor's pretty mediocre, but the weapons are really good, and you'll find something for every class that you might run into. You'll find bows, and you'll find slings, and it's almost like they were waiting for you to break out. So, but so you don't have, you know, your equipment isn't imported, but your characters are, and you start with, you know, some of the more powerful party members from Baldur's Gate 1, you know, Minsk and Jahera. You know, Minsk is famous. He's the great fighter with his hamster, and Jahera the Harper, she's always very powerful, able to, you know, cast some healing spells when necessary. And you have Imowen the Bard helping you detect traps, and she can detect traps very, very well. She's going to detect most of them successfully. And so it's, you do feel like this is just, I just need to get out of these rooms. I just need to figure out the maze instead of feeling like I'm going to die at any moment.
Yeah. It also introduces three new classes, the monk, the barbarian, and the sorcerer. I take it that you didn't really play any of those?
I don't like monks because I think swords are better than hands.
Racist.
Sorcerer, there's always an interesting idea. I've never actually played a sorcerer, but I've seen them played.
Yeah, you get some pretty crazy spells, stuff like chain lightning and everything. You always gotta love when a high level sorcerer.
Yeah, it's fun to experiment with these sorts of things. It'd be nice if there was, a little arena area where you could try out characters, but, you know, maybe for my next RPG when I make one.
But it also introduced half-orcs, dual-wielding katanas, subclasses for pretty much every class. There was a lot of customization in this game.
It really did feel like they dumped the rulebook in so many ways. In some ways, partly to the game's detriment in a bit, and that is what I think about the how many of the encounters would play out the same way, because that's how good players would play them out. And think specifically of, you would encounter a magic user and they'd have all of their shields up, so you'd have to start with your piercing stuff and all these things to get through the mage's defenses first. That becomes your priority. And, you know, that's great, and that's what is what would happen in a D&D campaign. But it did feel like, especially for the as you move on to the higher levels, you're fighting the same battles over and over again because you always need to take the first initial steps. And because, you know, you have to pierce the spell wall, like get rid of all of the repel missiles or repel magic damage and all of these magical defenses that every smart D&D player would definitely have before they went into combat. But then you encounter them as a player going into this game and it feels like, oh crap, not this again. which I always found a little bit annoying. I mean, so for some people, I'm sure that's part of the tactical minigame. That's part of the puzzle they need to fix, you know, getting their mages into position and protecting their own mages so they can get their defenses up and also their offenses out. I find that a little tedious, but I'm sure some people really, really love that.
So from a story point standpoint, like a lot of isometric RPGs of that age, you're dealing with gods and monsters, basically. Mm. But I'm curious, like, BioWare is famous for having a really, like, great cast, like, very memorable characters. I mean, we've highlighted some of them in our discussions of Mass Effect and KOTOR. Walk me through Baldur's Gate 2's cast, and how do you think it stacks up compared to some of their later work?
I think John Irenicus is often, he's the villain, the main antagonist through Baldur's Gate 2, and I think he's often given short shrift as far as RPG villains, BioWare villains. I mean, he doesn't have Kraya's Great Majesty from KOTOR 2, but he does have this pseudo-tragic love story, ambition story. He falls in love with the Queen of the Elves, then he tries to become a god and has to be cast out of Elfland. He loses his soul. It's a very dark and tragic story.
He and Elfo left Elfland together.
Yes.
Sorry, that was a disenchanted reference.
Oh, that show. I think he is a very interesting villain. I think he does have, he certainly has more motivation behind him than I want to conquer the world that Saravok did in the first Baldur's Gate. he has this, you know, he wants to be a god. Everybody wants to be a god. You know, why not? He's a torturer.
I don't want to be a god. I want to just be so
god.
You know.
You don't. I love.
You want to be a god?
It depends on the worshippers and what kind of sacrifices they offer. I guess we'd have to work that out in the book.
It's all about the sacrifices. Okay,
it's got to be the right kind of cow.
Troy likes his human hearts fresh.
they can just offer me barbecue ribs. I'm fine. Ironicus is. It's clearly a villain. They don't try to make you feel sorry for him, but it's clear that he and his sister have been through a lot. His sister becomes a vampire, and he becomes this twisted guy trying to find his way to godhood. He does a lot of really bad things, but there is a motivation, and it's understandable motivation. He becomes somebody you want to take down, but, you know, you get the hints that he was once actually a pretty decent guy. He just got sucked in by the appeals of, you know, magic and deity. And it's a common story, I think, in a lot of RPGs. I think this is a theme in a lot of JRPGs as well. You know, the person who just wants to become more than they are and just loses their mind. I really think he does stand out with some of BioWare's very, very best villains. Even, I mean, the Baldur's Gate series, I think he's clearly the best and the best drawn. A lot of the party members don't quite make the same impact that they did in the first Baldur's Gate. And I think that's because some of the first Baldur's Gate people are coming back, and they're always much more fun because you remember them. But also there are so many more party members to pick up in Baldur's Gate 2 that it's hard to get a good feel for where they all fit, except for, you know, the person with their inevitable betrayal. There's always an inevitable betrayal. Many of them aren't as well drawn as in the first Baldur's Gate, but a lot of the characters you meet in your quests, you know, the dragons and the characters in the Underdark, a lot of the drow characters stand out. The game is so big that each, you know, subquest on your way to the main quest has somebody giving an interesting monologue, which I think is, you know, typical BioWare. And this is, I think this was the first BioWare game that had romances, where, you know, romance is such an expected part of the BioWare formula now that it wasn't in all of their games. But Baldur's Gate 2 had, you know, one, you know, male character for a female player to seduce, and like five or six women that a male character could seduce, because that's the way games were in the 90s. And I think this was the very first game that had, you know, dialogue options leading to a romantic conclusion. So you would have little Stude learn more about, you know, Eri or Jahera or Viconia or whomever you were approaching for romantic interludes, and get some interesting bits there.
So, which character did your character end up dating?
I was kind of a mushy, weak weirdo.
Gotta commit. Persona 4 taught me that much.
I committed. I chose Aerie. I chose, you know, the damaged circus girl. Because, you know, that's the white knight in me. Gotta save the damsel in distress. You know, that's someone who's probably more of a pushover. Not that I've been attracted to pushover women in my real life, but, you know, something about it in the fantasy world sort of spoke to me. I don't know what it was. I'm sure a therapist would have a great time with it. All of the women I've dated have always been, you know, formidable, strong, intelligent, powerful people. And Aries, you know, kind of this such a sweet little girl who's hurt and she's always looking up to you. I mean, and it's just, it's kind of cotton candy sweet and nothing like anyone I've ever dated, but yeah, that's kind of who I ended up with.
Well, do I have some moe RPGs for you? But another thing that was kind of interesting about Baldur's Gate 2 was multiplayer co-op. And thinking about, so I think Baldur's Gate 2's multiplayer co-op was kind of notoriously broken in some ways. But at the same time, I like the sentiment behind it, because frankly, we need more multiplayer RPGs in our life. And we've got Divinity Original Sin. Dragon Quest IX back in 2009, I thought did it tremendously well. But otherwise, they're relatively few and far between.
It was kind of a dry run for Neverwinter Nights, wasn't it, in many ways?
Yeah, I would say so. But at the same time, like, RPGs, we tend to think of them as these super single-player experiences, but in fact, they are the most multiplayer co-op experience that you could possibly have, dating back to the days of the tabletop adventure, where you had a dungeon master setting everything up and laying out the story for you, and a party of adventurers working together, figuring out how to get past traps and monsters, communicating, building up their characters. I feel like so many of RPGs like lose that element, and so it only makes sense for me for a game like Baldur's Gate 2 to have that.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were trying to be as faithful as they could to the, you know, the second edition rules. I guess it makes sense for them to make the effort. I mean, I never tried it. I have no idea. I did hear it didn't work all that well.
No, it didn't. But... it was the late 90s.
But, you know, you gotta appreciate the ambition of it, I guess.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing that you would be playing maybe with your friends over a LAN if you were doing a LAN party. Did you ever play Baldur's Gate 2 at a LAN party?
I did not.
Alas. Maybe a missed opportunity, or maybe something you could do now, though you don't really have to do LAN parties anymore, sadly. The day of the LAN party is done.
Yeah, well, you know, we still do them sometimes for our media events.
That's true, that's
you know,
true.
Sometimes you, you have a bunch of media in a room, and there's as close as we get to LAN parties these days. I mean, I've been to LAN parties, but I can't remember the last one. Certainly not for Baldur's Gate 2, but for RTSs it was very common. But never for an RPG, you're right.
Oh, maybe Diablo.
Maybe Diablo. Yeah. Certainly Doom.
Yeah, Diablo 3 just came out on Switch, and I think that will be getting a lot of people into multiplayer dungeon crawling. But and of course, like most PC RPGs, Baldur's Gate 2 has a lot of mods. So many mods. And to the point where, like, some of the mods, I believe, are considered canon by the fans because they just are seen as essential. How much did you end up modding Baldur's Gate 2?
Oh, not much. Not much at all. I mean, even still back then, I was more of a strategy war game person than an RPG person, so I wasn't, my second favorite genre. But I was never dipped too deeply into the modding pool. Did I miss anything really important?
I mean, there's a huge number of mods out there, like a ridiculous number, and there are some that the fans definitely consider essential. Like, I would encourage people to, if they want to try Baldur's Gate 2 again, to go and research them. In the meantime, I'm actually not much of a modder myself, because, like, I think the biggest exception maybe is, say, Skyrim, because when I got my current PC, I really wanted to try Skyrim in all of its graphical glory. And so I got like every single graphical enhancement that I could possibly find. But I didn't get too many of the gameplay changes. Like, there's one in Skyrim that revolves around survival, like kind of a built-in survival mode with a lot crunchier elements. And I respect the hard work of these modders, and I think many of them are really excellent. But there's always that layer of amateurishness, I suppose, to the design of it that kind of takes me out of the world. And ultimately, I'd rather be able to go with the professional tools and everything that the developers can bring to bear. One thing we always do with this top 25 RPG list, Troy, is we always pick out the best moment in these games. And I mean, you really like Baldur's Gate 2. There are so many memorable moments. What for you is the best moment?
I think, you know, the battle in the Tree of Life. It's just a really great setting. The stakes are there. The score kicks into high gear. It's a very powerful encounter. I mean, I think it's one of the best opening set pieces of any of the BioWare games. Like, if I could just say, oh, the opening escape is great. But I think the climactic battle at the Tree of Life in the elven city of Slundsar, or whatever its weird elvy name is, I really, that just, you're fighting on the branches, and it's not the final battle, but it's like the almost final battle to try to keep the tree from being poisoned. And I just think everything builds up to that moment in such a nice way, because, you know, Irenicus is a real threat at this point, and you're trying to save Elfmanity.
No, that's Elven a word.
Elvenkind. There we go.
No, we're going with Elfmanity from now on.
God, my brain's broken, Elfmanity. I really think those are the moments that stand out for me. How about you?
Well, I think the first moment that John Irenicus breaks out of spell hold is pretty amazing, because it really establishes him as just, you know, a total badass, right? And then there are a much later point, I believe the protagonist ends up kind of losing their soul, which is a little embarrassing. And you don't want to lose your soul.
Where do I put that?
It's a big moment in the game, I would say, wouldn't you? Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the plot reversals where you think things are going great, then you lose that, and you have to fight to get it back and do more quests, all the while, you know, being not quite human. And I think Emma, when it happens to her too, I believe as well. So yeah, that's really that is a really really great moment.
So one of the key metrics I have when I'm making this list is, inevitably, I always try and look at the RPG and think of it, does it hold up? How does it hold up? And some of the games on this list definitely hold up better than others, but ultimately I'm looking for games that still have a fan base, that we're still talking about to one degree or another. I think that we're still talking about Baldur's Gate 2 to this day. People are already very hyped for Baldur's Gate 3, and as somebody who really enjoys this game, why is that? Why is it held up so well, given that, I mean, if you want to break it down in the most base way, if you want to be really reductive, it's just a D&D license game.
Yeah, but it's weird, isn't it, how all of these companies are trying to recapture that magic. We have, you know, Obsidian's Pillars of Eternity games, and we have, they all have the Infinity Engine look, and yeah, we have Baldur's Gate 3 coming out, and we have remasters of the Baldur's Gate games. There was something about them that I think it's not simply, part of it's nostalgia, but I don't think it's simply nostalgia for Baldur's Gate 2. I don't think, you know, the Infinity Engine necessarily holds up that well. I'm not sure the isometric look is really the best way to do these games these days. But Baldur's Gate 2 was, its scale was super impressive. It felt like a major long campaign you are running with your friends. There were so many choices, so many options. You could have different experiences depending on the class of the character you were playing entirely, or, you know, which of the funding options you took in the opening chapters.
Magical GoFundMe for Elfmanity.
Exactly. God, I'm full of bad words today. It holds up because it is, I think this is the game that made BioWare. You know, Baldur's Gate 1 was great. It was a great game. I think Baldur's Gate 2 is what showed what BioWare is capable of. That is, you know, very large, very deep, in some ways emotionally rich role-playing games. It just happened to have a D&D license, because if you're going to sell a fantasy RPG in those days, it would be very hard to do it for the PC without some sort of license attached to it. There really weren't that many.
Are you saying that MDK2 didn't make BioWare what it is today?
It's, you know, you got to start somewhere.
You certainly do. And BioWare was definitely really leading the way at that time, right? I mean, we have a lot of love for Black Isle Studios. They were pioneers in their own way as well. Yeah. But in so many ways, Black Isle and Obsidian were following in the footsteps of BioWare. Like, BioWare would lead the way, and then they would come in and just like, well, here's our take on it. And there was a wonderful kind of give and take between these two massive RPG studios in the 90s. But I think BioWare's calling card at that time was just, they would put out a wonderfully realized, in-depth world with massive scope, one that you wanted to go live in. And Baldur's Gate 1 was, I mean, a lot of people would say it was transformative in the way that it was accessible, for sure, compared to previous PC RPGs. PC RPG hardcore people from the 80s would probably grumble about Baldur's Gate making it too accessible. Nowadays, we would see Baldur's Gate as being extremely hardcore. But yeah, it made things accessible. It introduced these choices that went far beyond, well, are you going to join the good guys or the bad guys? Like, there's a lot more gray area in there. And often you would have to be thinking really hard about what's the right decision. And that's what you want in an RPG, right?
Yeah, and then if you go into, you know, Baldur's Gate 2, Throne of Baal, I mean, what I did see of it, what I know of it, I mean, a lot of it falls into what does it actually mean to be, you know, the child of the god of murder? Mm-hmm. You know, that is actually an interesting question. You know, find out that you're not just, if the first Baldur's Gate, you don't find out you're just a demigod, you're the spawn of one of the worst and the cruelest gods there are. And Irenicus tries to, you know, get that god power out of you, and then Throne of Baal is about what does it actually mean to be the child of murder. And there's this whole arc all the way through that I think makes the Baldur's Gate games stand out. And I think they've, you know, kind of been overshadowed a bit by BioWare's you know, more mature games like Knights of the Old Republic and Mass Effect. But God, I mean, I think Baldur's Gate 2 really, really holds up as their masterpiece.
So, yeah, so BioWare, so fair to say, BioWare's magnum opus. I mean, KOTOR put BioWare on the map, I would say. Like, we were talking about this previously, and it's still a magnificent game today. That's why it's on the top 25 RPG list, and God, I wish they would make another KOTOR. You suck, EA. And Mass Effect gave it a truly mainstream following in a way that I don't think BioWare had ever really had before, because, I mean, it was a shooter. But I don't think either can come close to topping basically the sheer depth and quality of Baldur's Gate 2. I mean, Baldur's Gate 2 was BioWare just leaving it all on the line, and they weren't making an engine. They weren't, unlike with Mass Effect, they weren't dealing with the Unreal Engine for the first time, for example. They were able to craft so much content and really go out there. And in that respect, so when you look at the entire catalog of BioWare RPGs, and I mean, there are a lot of them, three of them are on this list. Baldur's Gate 2 maybe stands above them all. All right, so that's Baldur's Gate 2. Final thoughts, Troy?
I'm really glad you invited me on to talk about this. This is a game, I don't get to talk about RPGs a whole lot because my podcast is mostly about tanks and swords.
Yes, but I mean, it's fairly related, right? I mean, because
there's a lot of blending between the RPG and strategy worlds, which I really love. But it's great to have a chance to talk about one of my all-time favorite games. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, you're welcome. And it's been fun to be in this business over the years, because I missed out on Baldur's Gate 2 the first time, mostly because, I mean, I was a Japanese RPG player, console RPG player in the late 90s, and so I missed a lot of these games. But having the opportunity to go back and revisit them was really cool, especially with the enhanced editions. So, and I think that Baldur's Gate 2 really now has a pretty remarkable legacy for, as I already said, a licensed game, a game that ultimately does reach back to the very roots of where RPGs came from with the D&D license. But okay, so that is number 10, Baldur's Gate 2. We'll be continuing on probably next week with the next one in the line. We'll finish this list eventually, I mean, in 2019, I guess. But Troy, tell me a little bit about your podcast and where we can find you.
I co-own a podcast with Waypoint's Rob Zachney called Three Moves Ahead. It is about strategy and war games. I'm not on it as much as I used to be because I'm a busy, busy man.
Alas.
We have a lot of great panelists talking about strategy and war games at Three Moves Ahead, and you can find it at threemovesahead.net, part of the Idle Thumbs Network.
Okay, Troy, thanks for coming on the show, and we are going to quickly move on and wrap things up. Thanks to Troy Goodfellow for coming on the show, and we are going to be going on vacation, a nice little 4-day break after a long review season, and also, of course, Black Friday is happening, will have happened as of the recording. I hope all of you had a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family. I hope you guys didn't have to go out and work during Black Friday. And I hope that you had the sense to not go out and stand in line. It's much better to maybe enjoy all of the turkey and all of this, the fixings. But hey, I'm not going to tell you how you're enjoying your life. Yeah, I really appreciate all of you guys who have been listening to us over the course of this is the 183rd episode of Acts of the Blood God. It's longer than any of my other podcasts. I'm thankful for all of the RPGs we've had a chance to talk to. I'm thankful for the guests who have come on the show to talk about RPGs with me, including Nadia, Troy, Mike, Katie, everybody on the US Gamer staff, and on and on and on. And of course, I'm thankful for you guys for continuing to support the podcast. Thank you very much. So, Acts of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. We're actually on Spotify now, or should be. I submitted it just the other day. So if you want to listen to us on Spotify, you should. And if you're listening to us on Spotify for the very first time, welcome to the family. Make sure to subscribe and put it on your podcast machine. We will be back, as usual, next week to talk about even more RPGs, including number 9 on our top 25 RPG list. But until then, I've been Kat Bailey, and for Troy, thanks for listening. Happy adventuring.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.